guest this week is Jeff Van Gundy, former head coach of the Knicks and Rockets. He's a color commentator on ESPN, and he'll be on the call for Cavs Warriors on Christmas Day. The other people on the call are going to be Mike Breen, Mark Jackson, and then Lisa Salters is going to be doing reporting. Jeff, how excited are you for this game?
Well, I think it's going to be hopefully a very good regular season game. I don't think it has any long-term implications, but I think it should be a fun game to do and fun game to watch.
Yeah, none of these games really have any long-term implications. The big story last week was when the Cavs set out their big three on a trip to Memphis. Let's say Jeff Van Gundy is the commissioner of the NBA. How would you deal with the situation where these regular season games don't necessarily have a lot of meaning and players can sit them out? Like, what would you do? Would you make them sit at home, or would you make there be less games, or how would you address this issue?
I don't really think the commissioner has a great any one thing that he can do other than to implore the owners to appreciate their fans more. A lot of fans play a lot of money, and I think there are about 20 guys in the league that fans actually buy tickets to see. And Kyrie Irving and LeBron James are two of them. And so I think at some point, if you disrespect your fans enough, it will hurt your business. And I really think that's the only thing he can do. If he says they have to play in every game, they can just make up injuries to rest. Right. So, listen, this is not a commissioner's thing. This is where ownerships recognize the importance of the fans instead of just giving it lip service and giving them the respect of their paying customers. And then really the players having a Michael Jordan-like attitude, especially those 20 guys that people buy tickets to see, that they have a responsibility to their fans to play when healthy. And I feel badly for fans right now because in some ways we perpetuate a bait and switch type of mentality where we say, come watch certain guys, and then those guys aren't there when they could be.
I agree with you on the notion that they can't keep billing these players to be in these games when they might be sitting out. But I can also understand why a player of LeBron's stature would want to be getting some rest, because a lot of people have perpetuated the notion that the only thing that matters in benchmarking an NBA's career is the amount of championships that he's won. And he's had a lot of miles on his tires at this point. He's played deep into the postseason every year. I know you can make the same argument about Michael Jordan, who played 82 games in a season when he was 40 years old. But I think for a lot of fans, the greater good is preserving LeBron for the long term. But I would say that if he's going to get his rest, that they should do it at home games as opposed to away in a city like Memphis, where those fans only get a chance to see him once a year.
Yeah, I disagree with the media-driven assessment that your worth as a player is just based on championships. Two, I don't think sitting him out every you know, like two or three or four games a year preserves him. I think the way he takes care of himself is what preserves him. And if they're not healthy enough to play in games, or then we should play less games. And to James' credit, he suggested that. But players and owners don't want to take less money, so they want to make the same amount of money, but they don't want to play in the games. And that makes no sense to me. It's disrespectful to the fans, to me. And you know, I know there's a lot of different ways to look at it, and I just absolutely disagree that the fan should always come last. And that's how we right now with in this aspect, we treat our fans, that the fans come last. Their needs are less important than that of those players.
That makes a lot of sense. Switching to the Warriors, everyone knew that they were going to be somewhat of a juggernaut, given that they set the NBA record for wins last year and then added Kevin Durant, who's one of those people you were talking about that people really go and pay their money to see. But are you surprised that they've gelled this well together this quickly?
No, I mean, they're a great team who added a great player, you know, and so I think the hand-wringing by the media about how long it was going to take was nonsense. Great players can fit in with other great players if they have the desire to sacrifice and share. And I think Durant has no problem. Curry has no problem. Their guys are the way they play and the way they get rewarded for their sacrifices through winning will lead them to another dominant year.
I asked Jalen Rose this question a few weeks ago. And do you think that there's a team not named the Cavs or the Warriors that's going to win an NBA championship in the next three seasons? So that's this year and the two after it?
Well, it's hard to predict health. So, you know, I would never try to predict health. Healthy, though, I don't see anyone other than the Warriors winning.
I can definitely see that as well. Kevin Durant left Oklahoma City, and Russell Westbrook is just tearing it up this year. Like, there's a chance that he might average a triple-double for the season. Setting aside the notion that Oklahoma City might not be the most desirable market for a free agent to go to, do you think that the season that he's having, where he has the ball in his hand so much, do you think that might detract potential free agents from going there, or do you think that a top-tier free agent would want to go play with him because of his intensity and his drive?
Well, I think money is the number one thing for most players, right? They're gonna go where the money is. So I think playing with Westbrook would certainly not be a deterrent to going. But I think when it's talked about money or the ability to win championships, you know, they've had a talent drain in Oklahoma City over the last 4 years with Harden and Ibaka and Durant. So they're not close to right now to winning the championship. And
right.
Last year they were. And it's unfortunate for them and their fans that they were so close so often and for a number of different reasons, you know, just, you know, couldn't get over the hump. But I think if you're a serious basketball player with serious goals and value winning, you would like to play with a guy like Westbrook.
Have you followed the, like, details of the new CBA where it really, really, really heavily incentivizes players financially, especially stars, to stay in the markets that drafted them? It's getting called kind of the Kevin Durant rule, but it's really going to apply to players like Karl Anthony Towns and Anthony Davis, who are in smaller markets, and they can get these like $200+ million extensions by staying there, but make a lot less by leaving. Do you think that that's good or bad for the game?
Well, I don't know. I think it's good for those franchises, certainly. And yet, if I was a player, I'm not going to think about just the amount I would be losing if I left, because I already have enough for my family and my family's family and on down the line. I don't know exactly what the difference would be, but I would go where I had the chance, because it is a short career, to be the happiest I could be. And whatever that means for an individual player, I would follow that versus just saying I can make X here and it's X amount more than what I could do if I left to somewhere else. So I wouldn't be bound by that if I was a player.
One of the biggest changes in basketball the last few years versus when you were in the coaching ranks is the amount of three-point shooting has just skyrocketed. There's teams like the Rockets and the Warriors whose their like entire livelihood is basically based on their ability to make threes. Do you think that this is like, Brad, a better game of basketball from your standpoint, or like, let's put you in the like commissioner role again, would you maybe think about moving the three-point line back a little bit given how many of these shots are being attempted now?
No, the one thing I would do is I'd widen the court a little bit so the three-point shot was the same from the corners as it is above the break. It makes no sense to me that for a shorter shot, you get the same amount of points. I've never really understood that. So I would do that, and then you could play around with moving it back at some point if you thought that was necessary to give more diversity to the offensive games. I think, listen, it's a lot. This is an influence that goes way back to Daryl Morey coming into the Houston Rockets, who I worked with for a bit. And I think it's skyrocketed from there. The mathematical bent to how people play, and Houston, obviously, with Mike D'Antoni, believes in it to the extreme, and they have gotten off to an incredible start relative to their level of talent and really have taken advantage of their roster and the greatness of James Harden as well as anyone could have. So I think you just have to wait and see, but I would like to widen the court so the three-point shot was the same distance everywhere that you get rewarded for 3 points.
Which young player in the league would you most want to have on your team right now if you were coaching?
You know what? The hard part about evaluating stuff like that is you don't know a player until you're actually with them every day. Some of them, some of the players that come off the worst in the media when I coached were absolute joys to coach because they were team-oriented and they were tough, and they really just had no time for the media. And others who were beloved by the media were locker room cancers because they knew how to play the media game, what to say, who to suck up to. And so I think, listen, you don't really know a player until you're there every day as a coach. And so I would hate to say from afar, that's the guy I'd want when I have no knowledge of what his true personality is like.
Is there any way I can get you to name names on a player who was great with the media but was a cancer in the locker room?
No.
had to try. I was in the building for the Mike and the Mad Dog reunion earlier this year where you gave a really fun interview. One of the stories that you told involved John Starks ripping a lamp out of the wall in a hotel room and tossing it at Don Nelson. Can you like replay the context of that story?
Well, I would, you know, listen, coaches and players always have interactions that behind the scenes can reach the boiling point. And John, in that situation, you know, he overflowed with emotion over going to the bench. But listen, you give me John Starks any day of the week. That same passion that overflowed then showed up on a regular basis when he played. And frankly, that level of competitive spirit that you see with players like John, that's as hard to find as any skill in the NBA right now. True competitors who are not ultra-sensitive. Listen, we miss guys like John Starks. We miss that type of disposition in our league today. And, you know, I think that one incident just showed you how deeply his passion was and his belief in himself was.
Yeah, but you said that he did it because, like, he got benched for Hubert Davis and Don Nelson said that, oh, well, he's better than you. I wasn't saying it as, like, an indictment on Starks. I just thought it was a funny story.
Yeah, that, no, I mean, listen, after the fact, it's funny. Yeah.
You've had a pretty, like, wide coaching tree of assistants who have gone on to become head coaches and have success with like, Mike Malone and Steve Clifford and Tom Thibodeau. So this is a two-part question. A, did you realize at the time when you were a head coach that these people were going to be very suited for a head coaching job? And B, what is it about Patrick Ewing that he's been an assistant for so long and nobody's given him a chance to become a head coach yet?
Well, listen, it doesn't take long to work with people to know just how good they are. And so, in particular, because I worked with them longer, Tom and Steve, you knew they were great coaches. Now, it took a long time for Tom to get his first opportunity, and it just shows you how hard it is to hire a head coach, because he was in the league 20 years working for some great teams, great organizations, and it was hard for him to even get an interview. And he's turned into an absolutely elite coach, but only Chicago recognized it. And I would say New Orleans with Jeff Bauer offered him the job same year. And I believe Rod Thorn at the Nets offered him the job the same year. So he had three offers. But the previous 19, it was a hard thing for him to even get an interview. And Steve Clifford, the same thing. You know, I think it was 10 years for him. He is a tremendous basketball coach, and I give Michael Jordan a lot of credit for recognizing that and hiring that, because, again, these guys were absolutely brilliant. They were beloved by the players as assistants. The teams they were on had some success. I don't know why it took so long, but as a head coach, you certainly know when you're working with guys just how great they are. And, you know, Tom and Steve were brilliant, and they helped me more than I helped them.
And Ewing, how you coached him for a while on some of those really memorable Knicks teams. He's like a big name as a former player, and he's by all appearances paid his dues. Is there some reason you can think of that he hasn't been given an opportunity yet?
Well, I think this, Patrick is by far the best player to have gone into coaching, to have paid his dues, to have never gotten an opportunity. I think there's some size discrimination. Big players are not viewed the same way as far as thinking the game as maybe smaller players were. And Patrick was one of the smartest players I ever had the privilege of coaching. He's worked diligently at his craft. He worked for Doug Collins, Stan, and now Steve. Steve promoted him to associate head coach. You know, I think we all believe that if given the opportunity, Patrick would be an outstanding head coach. But I have no idea why certain people get hired in this league and why others don't. It's personal preferences by owners and GMs. And I think Patrick's size, and I also think he hasn't ever gotten the best coverage from the media, which painted a portrait of himself as a player that was unfriendly. And if you knew him, he's got the utmost character. He's warm, he's gracious, he's humble, sincere, reliable, trustworthy, and above all else, absolutely loyal to team and players.
That's interesting. I'll be definitely interested to see if he gets a head coaching job down the line. It seems like it's long overdue for somebody to take a flyer at this point. You worked a while with Pat Riley, obviously, and worked under him. In assembling the big three with LeBron and Wade and Bosh, he was given a lot of credit for being magnanimous, and this all came back to like him being influential enough to get them all to agree to take Wes to play together. That's probably harder for the getting LeBron was the biggest coup of all those because he had Wade. But all three of those players since then, since their exit, well, Bosh hasn't really exited yet from Miami technically, but all three of them now feel a little bit of bitterness towards Riley. How does it make you feel to watch how this breakup has gone on between those three players and Riley?
Well, I think, first of all, their, quote, sacrifice to take less in Miami has been overblown. I think relative to their net worth, it was minuscule. So I think that level of, quote, sacrifice has been a media-driven thing. Secondly, when players leave a team, they view it as business. When a team gets rid of a player, they look at it like a lack of loyalty. Flip the script. When a team gets rid of a player, the team says that's just business. And when a player leaves, they think, you know, it's disloyal. It's so it's just different perspectives. It all comes down to business. It's one of the reasons why I hate the term family. No team is a family. It's a connected business that has, you know, the successful ones has exceptional, talented, determined, serious guys. And, you know, James has proven just how great he is over the course of his time. But because he won in Miami, I don't look at him any differently than when he lost in his first go-around in Cleveland. He was a great player. He helped his team achieve to whatever their talent level was. And then he went to Miami, and he had better players around him, and he won. He goes back to Cleveland. He has better players than he had around him the first time he was in Cleveland. And he won there, too. So he's had a remarkable career, as has Wade and Bosh. And a lot of this is just business. Players do what's best for them. Teams do what's best for them. And hurt feelings are just a part of it.
I'll get you out of here on this. I know you get tired of answering this question, and you've said that if like the right perfect situation came along, then you'd consider a return to the coaching ranks. If you had to put it on the odds that you're ever an NBA head coach again, like what out of 10 would you say are the chances of it happening?
I don't like look at it like that. I like the job I have right now. I love coaching as well. It was great. I did it for like, I don't know, 20 years, I think, in the NBA and or in that neighborhood. And it was wonderful. And I've enjoyed the broadcasting. I think I'm maybe at 10 years or 11 years. So, listen, no one's been more blessed than me basketball-wise. I've really been fortunate, and I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jeff. We really appreciate your time. Jeff will be on the call for Cavs Warriors ESPN Christmas Day. Thank you again, Jeff. Appreciate your time.
No problem. Take care.
Bye.